WhatFix is one of the finest example of a startup that went through many iterations and at the same time stayed really focused on building for the long term. WhatFix launched at Unplugged Conference, and when I read about their Series D round, I kind of felt obligated to release this AMA conversation which I had with WhatFix co-founder and CEO Khadim around 2020. This was an AMA conversation, so it has a lot of great questions from the audience as well. So here is Khadim really going unplugged about WhatFix journey and the sales process.
Thanks, Ashish, for the invite. So myself, Khadim, co-founder and CEO of WhatFix. WhatFix was founded by myself and my co-founder colleague Varak Kumar. Both of us been working together for now almost like 20 years, right? Last 9 years in building this startup, and before that, we built a BI product line in Huawei Telecom. So, we started a journey with different product that's called Search Enabler, where we wanted to help small businesses by improving their social media and search visibility, primarily building an SEO platform, social media platform for SMBs. And Ashish, as you know, in 2011-12, I think the only belief was like we should build a product which can cater to SMEs globally with a price point $30, $40, $50 kind of a monthly. So that's what we did. And primarily those kind of product has to be DIY to scale, right? You can't provide any kind of a touch there. That's what we tried. We got several customers, like 50, 60 customers. You can call it PMF, non-PMF. We can debate that later.
Right.
Right. But what we realized is there was one segment of customers that is a professional, the CEOs or social media guys were using it effectively. But there was a core segment which we were trying to target, that is the small business owners. They were not able to see the ROI because they were not able to implement the recommendation what we used to crunch and give it to them. So if we wanted to scale that product, we had to make it true DIY. So almost for a year, we tried several different solutions like building plugins for Joomla, Magento, or WordPress, trying API, several different ways. And one of the things which worked out well was providing them hand-holding in their own WordPress platform or their website console, giving them step-by-step guidance on how to fix any issues of their website. So that came out to be as a that was a byproduct which came out to be what is today as WhatFix, right?
Wow.
Even right. So it was not planned. It just happened. From there, we created a community platform because we thought we need to create tens of thousands of different fixes which we need to give it to the small business owner, and we created a crowdsourcing platform, something like SlideShare or YouTube called WhatFix.com, a community based where anybody can come and contribute their FAQs which are interactive. Gradually, we realized that folks were ready to pay for this. We started a bit of monetization with small businesses. Soon, we realized that we have to take a call because we were two guys and we can't keep building both the product like Search Enabler and WhatFix. So we decided to shut down the previous product. We refunded to some of our customers at that point. And then we started working on WhatFix. From there, again, small businesses, community, small businesses gradually went up to enterprise. And that's where we are today.
Interesting. So walk me through the early days of product market fit for WhatFix, because the problem statement, I believe, is not a very structured problem statement in even in SMEs, even in enterprises.
So I think we have went through several different steps, Ashish. As I was mentioning, like we initial days of WhatFix, we got some several small businesses coming to us saying that, okay, we would like to use WhatFix for handholding our end customers or end users on our SaaS platform or on our website. So there were several customers ready to pay for that, right? So even in Search Enabler, as I was mentioning, we had 50, 60 paying customers. So now when you get 50, 60 paying customers, even in WhatFix, we had 30, 40 paying customers at $1,000, $2,000 annual ARR. Now, we really call it as a product market fit, right? So we did think like, okay, we have a product market fit, we have several customers paying us a substantial amount. But then as you start going through the journey, you start realizing that can you build a substantial or large business out of this, right?
Yeah.
So the way you structure your go-to-market channels, the way you have your sales teams, your product team, your marketing team, your support team, success team, because some products need a lot more touch, some can be truly complete DIY. In our case, because it was an onboarding platform, it has to be integrated with underlying systems. There was some touch required even in the success phase, right? So again, we realized that $1,000, $2,000 would not justify the scale at which we want to go. So that was the point, like after getting several customers, after a few $100,000 ARR, we realized that we have to go up market at a much, okay, much higher price point. Again, there were several different thoughts at that point when we were debating whether can we go to enterprises in India, can we go to enterprises in US, can we crack enterprise from India to US, and several of the questions were there. We were able to do that gradually with several iterations. We were able to crack enterprises. And today, the exact use case is what we have a very strong product market fit is going to any enterprises or any company which is 1,000 employees and above. Typically, a company with a few thousand employees use few hundred software applications today internally, yeah, for the employees, right? Be it CRM, ERP, supply chain, and many of the softwares. And they need a lot of hand-holding to ensure the softwares are getting adopted and the companies see ROI from tens of millions of dollars what they're spending.
Yeah.
So this came out to be a very good fit for WhatFix. Like, companies started using WhatFix internally for helping their employees to adopt CRM, to adopt ERP. And this software continuously iterate, right? The CRMs like Salesforce or Dynamics, every quarter they roll out new features. Companies keep rolling out their new processes. Companies keep rolling out their new compliances required by their employees. So there's a constant need of WhatFix quarter on quarter or month on month or week on week, where they would use WhatFix for remote onboarding, remote training, on-demand onboarding, on-demand training, on-demand support. And that's where we are getting terrific traction.
Interesting. So these are essentially product trainings, right? So do,
yes,
you also partner with the product companies for the distribution that, you know, even if you're able to sell, we are still going to go ahead and train your customers. So do you follow that approach or...
Yeah, so it's very natural, right, Ashish, that this thought comes in, right?
yeah, you know, so, basic danda.
Exactly. So that's what we thought, actually, Ashish, like we have to go behind this. Any enterprise software, right, whether CRM, let's say Salesforce, or any large SIs have huge amount of practices with thousands of employees, and thousands of people implementing those softwares. So it's very natural, go to this large SI, SIs saying, okay, when you deploy the CRMs or ERP, take us along. Or go to this software vendors, when you are deploying, your customers, enterprise customers, typically tailor your software for 40-60%. So default onboarding, default training, or default help doesn't make sense. It has to be customized again. So why not WhatFix? So it can make very, very solid sense. But we realized we thought the same 3-4 years back with this thought when we started pitching to SIs, large SIs, when we started pitching to software vendors, everybody entertained us to talk, but we didn't get a dollar. Right? It took almost 18 to 24 months to see the first couple of deals from these large SIs. They are elephant. It's hard to move. Everybody likes it, but then you don't know how to milk them, right?
Yeah.
And second, when you yourself are struggling with your positioning, your messaging, your playbook, it's hard to make somebody else do that.
So
once we cracked, like, how do I go and sell to a CRM user? How do I go and sell to SCM users? Our playbook started becoming so refined that anybody else, like any SIs, can easily replicate. So we tried hard. It didn't work. And then some of these SIs and software vendors started coming inbound. And by the time we had cracked our playbook, and then it started working. So in fact, last year, in 2019 calendar year, 25% of our revenue came from partners.
Wow.
Right? And we see this growing very rapidly. We at this point today, we have like almost like 13, 14 people, team in partnership and alliances group with dedicated focus on different regions. Within different regions, SIs and ISVs as the two different buckets which we are targeting.
Very interesting. So let's talk about this. Globally, the scaling part, how did the product evolve? You know, so first of all, as a founder itself, you know, how has your, you know, thinking process evolved, the whole approach towards product market fit, towards customers, how has that evolved over the last few years when you started taking the product to a global audience? I'll just finish because one of the challenges that I see with a lot of Indian startups is that we often end up building a lot of service and solutions when we are selling to Indian companies. But once we go out to a global audience, we realize that, you know, they need a much better product approach.
So again, Ashish, it a lot depends on how the approach, what approach founders has taken, what principles they also, well, sometimes it becomes principles of philosophical also, right? So or maybe there's a saying like once bitten, twice shy. So in the first product, what we tried, Search Enabler, we build a lot of features with assumptions. And when we started actually getting the customers, we realized that 40 to 50% of the features they never use. So we had to start throwing them off. And based on that experience, we decided in what phase we would not implement any feature unless 5 customers ask us and they're ready to pay. So it's just like we got more matured and we learned from the very hard way, right? So that was being the principle what we started with. We always create a mock-up. We always create a landing pages. We test it out with some of our potential customers or existing customers. Would they use this feature? Would they pay for it? And if we get positive response from few customers, then only we go ahead and implement. And that goes on till date, right? Now, now coming from the journey of how we took some of the decisions. So for example, broadly, we divide WhatFix into 3 major use cases, what WhatFix can cater to. So as I was mentioning, like any SaaS companies or any consumer companies can use WhatFix for onboarding their end customers, right? A SaaS platform can, or a banking platform can onboard their end users on there for payment gateways or anything.
Right.
Then, as I was mentioning, the second case, which we have a good product market fit, is large enterprises or enterprises using WhatFix on internal application. Now, internal applications can also be two different ways. One is bundled standard packages like CRM, ERP, which they buy. Or many of the softwares, they get it custom built, right? Either by internal IT teams or by the outsourcing to SIs or other vendors, right? Now, when you take these two major buckets, when the former buckets, when you cater to end customer base SaaS companies, who's going to be the buyer? The buyer is going to be a product manager, product owner. They would have stakeholders like marketing department because they want to onboard and simplify those onboarding, improve the conversions or something. They would have a designers as part of the stakeholders. So the expectation starts very specific to them, right? Product manager wants to see a detailed, deeper analytics. They want to, designers want a pixel perfect amalgamation with underlying platform. Marketing wise want to maybe do surveys, maybe A/B split testing and so many things along with WhatFix, what features we would provide. But when you go to the second major use cases that is internal to the enterprises, right? So the buyer persona completely changes. Yeah, the buyer persona might be your enablement. Let's say if I'm going and helping CRM onboarding, your sales enablement group might be your person. Buyers. If you're going to do a cross organization, L&D department comes in the picture. Now, when L&D comes or enablement folks comes into picture, their expectations totally differ. They are not ready to adopt or use any software which is technically very, very challenging for them. They don't want to modify any scripts or do any APIs and all because engineering is far away from them. Whereas the product manager can actually get an engineer to do it, right? But they need a lot more customization. So here the L&D folks or the enablement folks would need somebody, a product which can integrate very well with their existing knowledge ecosystem like LMS. Their knowledge repositories. Can it search across their repositories and bring it along with WhatFix? Can I do ticketing within them? So even the same platform, when I start looking at a two different person or use case, the requirement starts differing a lot. Right. So when I go deeper into one case, you start building a product which gradually starts looking very different than your competitors, very different than what the other segment would ask for.
Right.
So you have to pick your battle. You have to pick your use case and start going really deeper. When you start going really deeper, that's where we found so much of differentiation, so much of innovation, which actually helped us in winning very large deals, made us kind of a preferred platform for many of these enterprises.
Interesting. And given that it's a very horizontal approach, I would say, in terms of the product itself, how do you go about prioritizing? You know, given that you are catering to enterprises, so there'll always be the sales guy says, you know, we get a few million dollars more if we do this, while you know that the you know, the typical, you know, sales versus yeah. product management story, right? So how do you go about prioritizing and even defining the roadmap?
So actually, that's sometimes it's a very hard call. We have a lot of debates where there's an always argument that you don't want to lose some of the dollars which are coming in, right?
Exactly.
But it's a very short term approach versus mid to long term, which direction you want to go. Mm-hmm. Because the direction which we thought we have to take, right, by dropping some of the use cases and going to some of the other use cases. So what happens, let's say, for example, if I want to go deeper into my specific use case, let's say it's supporting HCM and CRM. Now I'll build a better integrations with HCM, better integration with CRM. My collaterals will be much better. My sales decks will be much better. My positioning, messaging, my go-to-market dollars, I will be attending the specific events. So gradually, that engine of go-to-market starts working very well.
Yeah.
My win rate starts increasing. My per customer dollar starts increasing, right? But this takes time, right? Because you have to start focusing on that in that particular use case. You have to start focusing the product into that directions, build those integrations and all. But at the point when you want to make decisions, there are customers coming from all the different segments.
Yeah.
So it's we had to take some of these hard calls. Even I was debating with myself many a times, like me and my founders and all. Do we drop this $15,000-$20,000 customers or we focus on here? So at some point we decided, okay, we want to drop one set of customers because we will want to go in this direction. We can't fight battles on all the front. We took these calls. We started prioritizing those requirements for the customers we say we want must have. Hmm. And the other customers were nice to have for us. We would not prioritize their requirement. If they join us still, they give us dollars, that's fine.
Right.
But the customers which are must have for us, we don't want them to churn. We want them to expand. We want to go deeper into that segments. Our win rate should keep on increasing. So those were the metrics we wanted to track. And that's how we took decision when going in deeper and deeper. And it so happened actually, right? So the stage where we were cracking few thousand dollar deals, we started cracking few hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So, yeah, so there are a couple of very interesting questions. I'll read them out to you. This is a question by Hardik. How did you make decision from targeting SMEs to focusing on large enterprises for core growth?
When we did initial SME customers coming to us, like if I remember correctly, out of first 25, 30 customers, if I say 25, like 24 would be small businesses and maybe one would be enterprise, but that enterprise also would be giving the price point of SME only. Right. Mm-hmm. So that initial data, that's how it happens. But when you start working with them, you start realizing like how well you are solving problem for that particular segment of customer. A small business, when we were targeting the kind of solution what we are providing, we felt they have their own priorities at that point. Their priorities mm-hmm. is a lot more growth. Their priorities is actually adding more dollars. Mm-hmm. Rather than they're focusing too much on onboarding, improving the conversions or improving the support, reduction of tickets and all. So sometimes you realize that, okay, your solution is a vitamin or your solution is nice to have for that particular segment.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have built a substantial size of business, but we thought that as we increase the size of the company, every like few hundred employees or thousand or few thousand employees, the WhatFix starts becoming from nice to have to must have there. So yeah. That was another reason we had to make that choice, right? Second, WhatFix is part of a new category. Like it was not a very well-defined category like a desk platform or a CRM or an ERP. Mm-hmm. So when it's a new category, most of the time there's not even a name coined for that category. Today it's called digital adoption solution, but there was no name, as you remember, Ashish, during Unplug also.
Yeah.
You were calling some yellow balloons and all. Right. So when there's no category defined, what would people search for in Google's? What exactly. will people search for in search engine, right? Today, there will be thousands of searches happening every day for CRM or other kind of a defined category. For WhatFix, there won't be any search. If somebody searches for support, there'll be hundreds of different solutions. WhatFix will be lost among them, right? Somebody searches for training, there'll be so many different. So since there is no defined category, you cannot have thousands of incoming inbound volume as well. So if there is a very low number of inbound queries as well from small businesses, it's very, again, hard, becomes hard to scale that business.
Right.
Third, we saw some of the larger enterprises coming inbound to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have my own hypothesis here, right? For example, if I share to some of my team members, like if a VP sales wants to change the stack of a CRM, right? He would not go and Google it, right? He or she would not Google it. Yeah. They would just roll out an RFP for a large enterprise and say to the procurement VPs that get me top three vendors, and they would get a Salesforce, Dynamics or someone or SAP to bid for that, right? Or three or four. So if you're not part of this three, four, you're nowhere for the larger enterprise. But once those CRM stacks are replaced, they want to do training, and the training is not working because of distributed workforce and the world is changing. Classroom trainings and other training, when they try and they discuss with L&D VPs, think, can you do something different? What would they do different today? So they would start reading at white papers, they would start discussing with analysts, or they would start participating in events, they would start looking what innovations are there. So even for a category, new category like us, there would be some enterprises coming looking for you, or they would start trying out even if you're a small company. So there's a window of opportunity. So we wanted to capitalize that. We realized that, and then we thought, okay, since enterprise market is wide open, why not try and cater to them? So one being, as I mentioned, small businesses we thought is nice to have, and too early for what fixed volumes were pretty low there because there was no defined category. And third, we thought the enterprise needs the software and they are looking for something like this innovative solution in today's situation.
Very interesting. Next question, how important is application telemetry to have data-driven understanding of SaaS? Have you decided to take this up? This is a question by Kavindra.
Yeah, so I would say it's as you start initially, it'll be like gut-driven. You start with gut-driven, then gradually as you start getting some traction, you start believing and looking at the data. Because to start with, you would hardly have any data, and you would be doing a lot of assumptions, hypotheses, or whatever data is available online, right? But as you start growing, like today we have a product team of almost like close to 20 people. So now we start believing a lot more on data, right? We start looking at every feature what we roll out, or every feature what we want to build. We look at data of adoption of those data, how those features are getting used or utilized. So I think you start from the gut, and then finally you start relying a lot more on data.
Interesting. So the next question is there any difference in the buying behavior in decision-making when it's between an Indian-based enterprise and an international one, especially in the B2B sales context?
Many, actually. I might have a lot of stories to tell, but I can't quote the names here. But I have, again, I have my own calculation here, like selling to an Indian enterprise and US enterprise. The effort to sell in US is 1/3 at 3x the price point. Right, yeah. So the difference is 9x. plus you have to keep coming behind. So I'll give an example actually, right? So very large enterprise in India in finance domain. I'll not name the company. A very similarly, very replica, very large company in US finance domain. Exactly same replica. I tried to sell in India for almost like few quarters, right? It's almost like a year. I ended up talking to CTO, global CTO. India CTO. It was an Indian company. So the CTO ended up telling me that you're asking me a couple of crores. Instead of that, actually, you should give me 0.5% equity to us because we are giving our brand to you. Okay. Vice versa, a US head of one of the departments, the team selected WhatFix completely. And it was, again, early days. We were also not sure what price point to give at the point. We gave some around $100,000 kind of a price, and we lost the deal. All the subordinates actually had accepted WhatFix. Finally, we lost at the signature table, and then there was no communication. Once we got our head of sales and we realized there was some communication, there was some connect there, common connect. We asked to verify what happened there. So we got to know that the quote what we gave, because of that we lost, because the person who chose the other alternative decided that kind of price point what we are saying, these guys don't even know that with that price point they can't even hire a single resource in US. Will this company survive? Right, so so you can see the difference. And an enterprise in US wants you to charge as for the value, right? And an enterprise, what we had experienced, like they wanted to ask for free. Right, so I'm not blaming all Indian enterprise, but this is the experience, my personal experience, within that same 12 months.
Yeah, I think this is pretty consistent experience. I mean, I end up talking to a lot of founders, and this is something that I keep hearing, that you know, Indian companies take time, they don't decide. In general, I think it's part of the culture to be indecisive, but let's not get there.
I hope, I mean, this was 4 years back. I hope this would have improved, because now we're actually 98% of our business is outside India, like 65% comes from US, around 20% from Western Europe and all. So we haven't started focusing back to Indian market as soon as things would have changed, I hope, in the last 4 years.
So what about your CAC? You know, is it like really high, comparable? I mean, you know, because selling to enterprises is, it's totally a different ballgame, right?
So I didn't get what you asking.
CAC, your customer acquisition cost.
Okay, CAC.
So is it really high, really low? You know, how does it work?
Like you looking at comparison between geography or in general, you're saying?
In general.
So it also, there are a lot of factors actually, Ashish, here, like how much you are able to do it remotely versus feet on street. And there are many factors, right? So early on when we started, the whole sales was from India, right? Completely inside sales space. Now, when you are doing sales from India to US and other international geographies with a substantial price point, your CAC is much lower.
Right? Yeah.
So maybe at that point, our CAC was like maybe 20-25% of the annual ARR.
Yeah.
So that was pretty good. And also we used to 80-90% of our customers used to pay annual upfront. Right. So. We hardly relied on VC money at the point to grow and all. But when you start growing and you start getting at larger deals, you need face time. You need people to start visiting customers. So even though your price points goes to from, let's say, a few $1,000s to a few tens of thousands of dollars, or maybe $100,000 or $200,000, when you start having a local folks in different countries with the local support system of sales engineering and solution and all, your CAC starts going rapidly.
Right.
Plus your acquisition channels, right? So initially we relied a lot on your acquisition channels like inbound, like your content, your SEOs or Google ads and other stuff. But then as you start getting into larger enterprises, you start relying on a lot of outbound channels. Like last year we did like more than 20 events where we were having booths and all globally. Having a lot of field marketing, small user groups. And so again, that adds to your go-to-market dollars as well. So as I mentioned, like CAC being like 20-25% went up to like 70-75% or 80% of the annual cost. So it started varying, but still, as long as the payback period is, let's say, 8-9 months, payback period is there, lifetime value is, let's say, 4-5 years. I think you can invest a lot upfront to grow rapidly.
Right. So it's a very interesting question by Karan on what input and output metrics do you track on a daily, monthly, and quarterly basis?
Today every department has their own set of metrics, which we secondary and primary metrics and all. But when we started, it all starts with initially with how much revenue you keep on adding, basically that ARR. And then you start looking at your churn metrics or renewal metrics, and then expansions, right? So today, actually, what we primarily look at is your monthly or quarterly ARRs, what we add. Because most of our customers are paying annual or multi-year upfront. So ARR is the metric we track rather than MRR.
Right.
Expansions and churn, that's so that we can get the net gross renewals. Apart from that, adoption of the software, like how they've been utilized across different cohorts. And then the NPS on the customer side. And then we are going a little deeper in each, like some of the areas which we want to keep on improvising. For example, in customer success, now we are tracking go live period, right?
Okay.
So are we able to go live the customers within 75 days, within 60 days, or within 90 days, or within 30 days? What kind of cohorts are going live when? Right, how much percentage of features they are adopting or what fixed. So these are the secondary metrics which gives us indication whether what's the health of those customers, whether we should focus on them. Then how many customers we are having quarterly business reviews in person or quarterly business reviews remotely. So we have a, like we need to have at least four business reviews every year, and at least one with the executive in person. So yeah. Several of these metrics are defined across now different departments, and mm-hmm. some we track at the organization level, some are tracked at the department level.
Interesting. So so when it comes to big enterprises, there's an interesting question by Santosh on, so do they expect on-premises solution or they're comfortably fine with SaaS?
So there'll be always, when you are in early stage of life cycle of your startup, everybody, mm-hmm. every enterprise would push you back saying that, do you have an on-prem? Yeah. Right. So we also had the same question, like everybody wanted specifically some customers in BFSI sector. Mm-hmm. And then when you start showing them the confidence that, okay, there are several of your peers or several of the industry large enterprises that have started adopting SaaS or cloud solution, the resistance mm-hmm. starts going down.
Okay.
Right. So we had all of those resistance. So we need to keep working around by giving them confidence. So we went with ISO certification, GDPR compliance, mm-hmm. SOC compliances. So several certifications pen test, vulnerability test, got this from large vendors, show them the certificates, build this confidence. So now actually we don't have that many requests, which used to be very early, but still there are, like today, if it was like 60%, maybe 3 years back, now it's like 5 to 10%. It's always there. Second, sometimes the product what you have also helps you in the way you can actually leverage those. So for example, with WhatFix, companies build content, which can provide mm-hmm. us in-app guidance and all. So what we built, like initially when we started having the several of these on-premise requirements, we created a hybrid kind of a model. Right. So you create the content using WhatFix on cloud, mm-hmm. right? Companies can use their test environment or non-production environment where there's no risk.
Okay.
So create those. We gave an option to export those WhatFix material or mm-hmm. flows or walkthroughs, what you call. And then they can put it in their production environment or their own cloud, private cloud, where the end customers would be able to use it or the employees yeah. would be yeah. use it. And there will be no interaction with the external cloud or there's no risk. So that hybrid initially worked really well for us. In that way, what happened is actually our features also got refreshed without overhead of maintenance. Whereas companies got their confidence level that, okay, no interaction data or no user data is going out.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so risk. So that worked initially, but gradually now, since we have enough logos, enough certifications, enough confidence level, I think we are not relying so much on those kind of models.
So, and do these external validations, do they help, you know, especially in enterprise world?
Yes. So, because those are some of the standard certifications like SOC mm. and ISO, yeah, yeah. and all. They give a lot of confidence level that, okay, this company is compliant and it's been audited and validated by third party. So it gives some level of confidence. Some of the companies ask for their own test. They would do their own security okay. test and evaluations. Some of them are fine with talking to some other reference customers about mm-hmm. their experiences. Looking at what are the peers, what are the customers in their domain are using, what kind of certification. So it's a different customers behave a little differently, but definitely it helps a lot.
Interesting. So let's talk about, we'll take this question before we move to the next part. So did you try freemium as a customer acquisition strategy? And if not, why? Is it because of custom integrations needed?
So we started actually as a premium, right? As I mentioned, we started with the community model. Even if you go to WhatFix.com and you go to the footer, there's a community version of WhatFix where anybody can start using it and integrate WhatFix. So that's how we started. We got a few customers there. But then, as I mentioned, freemium really works well, at least in our category, if it is like small to mid.
Yeah.
But when you start going to larger enterprise, specifically the buyer persona what we have, like going to enablement team or ops team or L&D team, very hard to expect those guys to come out and try and then buy. If it's a dev community or different kind of a community, you can expect a lot of proactiveness there. So the kind of product what we have, the segment what we were trying to target, I think we decided at some point that, okay, freemium would not scale for us and we can go back to the high touch model.
Yeah. I mean, the moment you move out of the SaaS, you know, I mean, the SME model, freemium actually doesn't make sense.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So let's talk about some of the updates with respect to COVID-19 and, you know, how are you guys looking at it? So with majority of the businesses adopting remote work more than ever, how well has the SaaS industry, especially companies like Hotfix, I mean, how have you been able to accommodate these demands?
So two ways, Ashish. One is, as a company which is going through this COVID situation, right? Mm-hmm. Internationally, like now we have like almost like 6 offices globally.
Yeah.
So apart from India, most of the other offices were pretty used to working from home. Everybody had the proper infrastructure and all, and primarily it's a GTM and support. India also, like R&D actually, there was a lot of co-location and a lot of team meetings and a lot of in-person discussions. They were not used to, and infrastructure was also not initially equipped for complete work from home. So the first couple of weeks, actually, we spent a lot of time in making it ready, like the readiness to, so that if eventually if we have to 100% work from home, there should be business continuity or not. Yeah. So I think that rapidly working on that actually helped. And so far, last couple of weeks, I think since everybody's 100% working from home, and we've seen since everything is fine, there's no impact to customers, the usage or the support, and everything is moving seamlessly so far. On the other side, actually, from the customer's perspective, right? So again, coming back to as companies move more and more remote today, or working from home and all, to make it more effective, the companies would start have to rely more on processes and tools, right?
Yeah.
And to ensure the compliance of processes and tools usage and adoption, I think the digital adoption platform like Hotfix becomes really key, right? Mm-hmm. So the customers which are already using Hotfix today, for last couple of years, they are seeing the benefits and they are actually asking for more licenses. So we are seeing some uplift there. We are seeing some attraction. For the new customers, where potential customers, where we are talking and all, we are trying to create that awareness and education that it will become even more inevitable and even more important to use Hotfix to ensure that you can make effective, make your workforce more productive, more effective in today's time. So there's a side we're looking at. So we see the platforms like Hotfix or digital adoption, this kind of a category, coming even stronger at some point once awareness is there in the market. Today, the penetration is only 5% among the whole market, addressable market. And we see 90-95% market is still wide open, where education has to be done and awareness has to be created.
Yep. So in general, what do you think SaaS providers should be doing more in these times to help their clients and customers?
So yeah, Ashish, actually, is the most important is business continuity is most critical, actually, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody's struggling, everybody's coping up with their people working from home. There is people are settling down. So having a disruption at this point is going to be not good. So ensuring business continuity is most important. Second, I think doing going proactively and doing a pitch to sell is not good at this time. Yeah. Need to be a lot more empathy has to be there. So if their customers are in a specific region or specific location are having a COVID problems and all, so whatever the company, a SaaS company, can do to help them out of the situation, if their product or something is can help in that situation, they should do it. Like some of our customers, we have proactively given some additional licenses if they are deploying Microsoft Teams or some collaborative tools, so that we can help them in this situation. And even though there's a budget freeze or something, at least temporarily we can help. So one is being empathetic, having empathize with them, providing if the solution can help in those customers in that situation, do that, ensure that there's an continuity for those customers, there's no disruption. I think that's the few things can be done at this point.
Sure. So last two questions. What are the top security certifications expected by enterprise companies?
Yeah, it depends a lot on the sector and segment, right? So if you're pharma, there would be specific certification. But being a horizontal company like us, so far ISO, SOC has worked well. SOC 2 and ISO has worked well for us. Apart from that GDPR and some privacy compliances. If you're catering to government agencies in US, FedRAMP kind of a certification would help. So it depends actually a lot on the sector and segment, actually. So if you're horizontal, ISO and SOC are must, I guess.
Okay. This is an interesting question by Santosh. When you're serving a category that is not there in the market, means no competitor to check the pricing, what strategy you follow for pricing, especially the US market? I think if you go back to the early days, pricing was really, I believe it's a great question in terms of, you know, the early days of WattFix and the category itself, right?
Yeah, so how the pricing evolved itself is a testimony, right? So in 5 years, our pricing is, you know, average pricing, it has become 40x than what it was.
Wow.
So you can imagine how much underselling we were doing. Anyway, there was a segment also was a little different. So you have to constantly keep evolving, right? So when you start selling initially, right? So the pricing is based a lot more on how much the customer is able to pay or how much you would make. Unit economics will be justified with this particular X price point. So that's how some of those basic assumptions you would have, like a man spending, let's say $100 to acquire the lead, and then after convert 10% is a conversion, it'll cost me $1,000 CAC or something. So I'll not sell less than $2,000. So that's how the calculation initially starts with the entrepreneur. But when you start really growing and at some point you get a product market fit, you have some substantial volume of customers, I think it's very natural to start going into value-based pricing. We were pretty shocked when we did a study with a few customers, like one of our CRM customers. When we did study, we realized that we saved them around $4.8 million of saving using WattFix for 5,000 of their employees on CRM Excel.
Mm-hmm.
If we wouldn't have that study, I think we would have continued charging in few tens of thousands of dollars. But when you start having those value parameters, your pricing power drastically increases. Customers' confidence also increases when you show them that these are the benefits they can accrue with WattFix. So you start with, initially we start with a lot more gut-based or CAC-based pricing, and then gradually you should start getting into value-based pricing. There's also interesting, like, again, the use case is what you cater, right? WattFix, as I mentioned, we had several use cases initially. If I am going to a consumer company, let's say e-commerce company, and WattFix can be used to onboard their merchants, and there are like hundreds of thousands of merchants. Whereas if I go to CRM where there are 2,000 CRM users, like I can't put a user-based pricing, right?
Yeah,
A CRM user is a vertical user, would be using that platform 6 hours a day. Whereas a merchant of a e-commerce platform might be logging in maybe twice a week, and they would need WattFix maybe twice a month. Right. So again, the pricing would also, we used to call that initial days very like creative pricing. Right. We used to understand the use case, each use case, debate with them, and then come up with the pricing proposal and give it to them. Now we have our own kind of a CPQ where we have different use cases and map the pricing parameters.
Cool. Awesome. I think that's pretty much what, you want to talk about. So great to have, some of these insights from you. And that's it. So wishing you all the best and safe time.
Thanks, Ashish.